looked into his beady brown eyes and growled, "I said, check with me tomorrow." His eyeballs darted back and forth in a Sister Thomas-like movement. He licked his lips. "Don't talk to me like that." In a flash, I grabbed the guy's tie and pulled it tight around his neck. Holding on firmly, I dragged him across the newsroom and into Assistant News Director Jim Johnson's office. I closed the door, hard. "Jim, if this guy talks to me again, I'll break his nose."
"O'Reilly, calm down. You can't threaten a manager."
"One more time, Jim. He's in the emergency room, and I'm calling the union rep right now. This idiot is out of line." Now, the interesting thing about this is, throughout all of it, the guy I was threatening said nothing. He just stood there with a stupid look on his face. Johnson, a good guy, didn't even address him. Jim knew what was going on in the newsroom, but was in a tough spot. He was powerless to change the station's management style, even though he knew it was wrong. Now a mini-crisis had blown into his office. Obviously, the bold, fresh guy had challenged management in front of everybody. Mutiny was brewing anyway, and if this got out of control, lifeboats might hit the water. Judging from his twitching facial muscles, Johnson was thinking fast. "I want you to calm down, Bill," Johnson said in a reasonable tone. "Fine, I'm calm. Keep him away from me." And I walked out of the office. A short time later, my friend Jeff Schiffman called me into his office, and we talked about the situation. He told me that Applegate wanted to fire me, but since I had a guaranteed contract, Wynn Baker, the general manager, didn't want the bad publicity that a public exposition would cause. Schiffman told me to shut up and avoid any felonies. A short time later, God intervened. Applegate left the station, his zombie hitmen closely following him out the door. Now, did I do the right thing? Not career-wise, that's for sure. Stories about me in the TV news business are legendary. In some versions of the above, I threw the guy into Boston Harbor. But I see it this way. I've got one life and no stomach for swallowing garbage like that. I took my chances, I slugged it out. Do I recommend that attitude for others? No, I don't. I am damn lucky to have survived in the TV business after pulling stuff like that. But for me, it proved to be basic training for what I'm doing now on The Factor, taking on the villains that are hurting the country. As you may know, my team of producers is perhaps the most feared in the media. If you abuse Americans, especially children, we will hunt you down. Bad judges, corrupt politicians and media people, evildoers of all kinds, are liable to be confronted at any time. My programs are dedicated to holding dishonest and downright bad people accountable for what they do. But far from being heralded in all quarters, this approach has caused major controversy. Who else does this on television? Who else makes judgments and exposes the powerful? Sometimes 60 Minutes, once in a while Frontline, Brian Ross does a good job on ABC News. But on a daily basis, The Factor is it. Those who see the world differently than I do are not happy about my work. In fact, some of them object strenuously to my very existence and vilify me at every opportunity. That's why I have to have security people. Believe me, if I didn't have a fire within, I would never put myself at such risk. Once again, I hope you're not reading this explanation as some kind of macho ego trip. I'm just trying to explain why I do what I do, how the Factor concept has become a crusade, albeit a polarizing one to some. It is my personal decision to slug it out. Nobody encouraged me to be me, but it has worked. Finally, my co-anchor in Boston was a very pretty woman from a civilized background, nothing at all like me. After witnessing the newsroom display I just described and a bunch of other stuff like it, she would just shake her head, sigh, and tell me I would never win with the confrontational approach. I hope she's enjoying this book. Chapter 13. Power. Being powerful is like being a lady. If you have to tell people you are, you aren't. Margaret Thatcher. In America, power and fame frequently intersect. A famous face opens doors, gets restaurant tables, and is offered all kinds of perks. That's power, in a sense. For example, nitwits like Paris Hilton and the rapper 50 Cent have that kind of a situation. They are certainly not powerful people, but in this celebrity-mad age, they derive benefit from their notoriety.
But the truly powerful on this earth all have one thing in common. Their actions and ideas can directly affect the lives of other people. In this country, that means that you and I can be disturbed, assisted, inconvenienced, or strengthened by the powerful. In this chapter, that is the definition of power that we'll explore. Back in Levittown, my family and I were essentially powerless. My parents had power over my sister and me, but that was it. And I had no power whatsoever until I became a teacher at age 21. Sadly, the O'Reilly clan was like many families all over the world, completely at the mercy of outside forces. As we discussed, that is never a good thing. Growing up, I had two minor brushes with fame. Some of you will remember the program Ben Casey, a medical drama that ran on ABC from 1961 to 66. The star of the show was a brooding actor named Vince Edwards, who each week scrubbed up, defied authority, and healed the sick. Dr. Casey, as I remember it, was usually teed off while treating patients, perhaps because another TV medical guy, Dr. Kildare, played by Richard Chamberlain, was getting better ratings. Anyway, Vince Edwards' older brother actually lived on Patience Lane in Levittown. He was the neighborhood celebrity. My gang, of course, nicknamed him Ben, which he did not like one bit. We, of course, could not have cared less. One fine summer day, without warning, the famous Vince Edwards himself pulled up in a black Cadillac to visit his brother. Immediately, chaos broke out. The entire neighborhood swarmed onto Patience Lane. This was huge. At that moment, the bold, fresh guy was playing baseball at the Caddy House Field about a half mile from Patience Lane. Suddenly, the game was interrupted when a Paul Revere-like figure appeared on a bicycle. "Ben Casey is at his brother's house," the kid yelled. "He's really here." Not even pausing for a response, the young Revere then pedaled off to tell the rest of the world of events, second only to Lexington and Concord. That was it for the game, as most of the guys, understandably, wanted to check out Ben Casey. Mildly curious myself, I joined the bicycle exodus, riding toward the action. Unfortunately, we got there too late. Little Helen Hanley, the younger sister of my friend Paul, ran over and told me that Ben Casey had just departed. Holding up a wrinkled piece of paper, she proudly displayed his autograph. Helen was in heaven. At dinner that night, my mother told my father that Vince Edwards had visited the neighborhood. My dad finished chewing, looked up from the overcooked meatloaf, and said, "So?" My father was pithy long before Dick Cheney. My other brush with fame occurred nearly a decade later and was a bit more complicated. As I mentioned, I wrote a column for The Circle, the Marist College student newspaper, co-edited by my roommate, Joe Rubino. Because we were constantly broke, Rubino and I were constantly looking for ways to beat the capitalistic system. Yeah, that's it. Eventually, we came up with a scheme that would allow us to access almost every entertainment and sporting event imaginable, free of charge. Feeling no remorse whatsoever, we founded a fictional press operation called the Intercollegiate Press. Stay with me here because this is brilliant. Located on the eastern bank of the Hudson River, Marist College back then didn't have a lot of amenities. It was a basic place, three dormitories, a library, a small gym. The snooty Vassar girls who lived on the other side of town might have called the campus quaint. But what Marist did have was its own little printing plant run by a man who looked to be about 106 years old. Nice guy, no clue. Because Rubino was constantly getting stuff legitimately printed for the Circle, the ancient guy would pretty much run off whatever Rubino gave him. One day we ordered two very official-looking press cards, each with our names clearly printed above this impressive imprint. Intercollegiate Press, the only weekly newsletter devoted to current events published during the academic year. Is that solid or what? Of course, there was no Intercollegiate Press, at least not on this planet. Credentials at the ready, Rubino then got the printer to churn out 1,000 sheets of paper with the IP letterhead. Armed with the press cards and the very impressive-looking paper, we got busy. Letters flew out of Poughkeepsie to many different concerns, and when the dust settled, we had secured free movie passes, Broadway play tickets, and complimentary admission to any ABA basketball game in the world. And listen to this. We also scored season tickets for the New York Yankees. My God. Once in a while, some public relations person would ask us what the Intercollegiate Press actually did. For example, where was it published? Where did the articles appear? Our reply was super slick. IP was a college wire service that went out to thousands of campus newspapers, whose editors then made up their own minds. Sometimes the editors incorporated the information we supplied into other articles written by their reporters. Sometimes they used our writing as standalone stories. As they say in prison, it was all good. Now, if Sister Lorana had known about this con, she would have collapsed on the spot. But rationalizing like crazy, Rubino and I felt no shame. After all, who were we hurting? No one. And who were we helping? Us! Case closed. Flush with initial success, we became more daring. In February 1971, I wrote to The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, then produced in New York City, and requested tickets so we could do a behind-the-scenes article on Ed McMahon, his sidekick. That, of course, would be for the benefit of millions of college students hungry to know more about Ed, with whom they all identify. Sure. Almost miraculously, 2 weeks later, a letter arrived telling us where to pick up tickets for the March 17th broadcast. That's right, St. Patrick's Day, the Irish display time. This was great. Back then, the Carson program was enormous. The entire country loved it and him. And now we had free tickets. What a coup. As Irish luck would have it, Rubino and the bold, fresh guy were already slated to be in the city that day because that's where the girls would be, celebrating their favorite guy, St. Patrick. So things were falling into place perfectly. On game day, we drove down to New York City in Rubino's brown, tinny Plymouth Duster, watched a bit of the big parade on Fifth Avenue, and then wandered over to Rockefeller Center to pick up the tickets. 10th row on the aisle. Choice. However, whenever things are going too well, you know what changes do. To our utter shock and disappointment, Carson was off that night, and Joey Bishop was subbing. Joey Bishop. Good grief. That was not good. For those of you who don't know him, Joey Bishop was a gentle comedian best known for hanging around with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin. For some reason, that to this day no one can quite figure out, Bishop was a certified member of the Rat Pack, which consisted of Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, as well as Frank and Dean. The pack roamed around partying and cracking wise, all the while milking an enormous amount of publicity. But believe me, Joey Bishop was a steep drop-off from Johnny Carson, like going from lobster to tuna. Slouching insolently in our fine seats, we watched as Joey took the stage and quickly ran out of material. He then grabbed a microphone and walked into the audience. Rubino and I quickly straightened up as Joey sauntered up the aisle, heading directly toward us. I remember thinking, why not? So I simply arose from my seat, all 6'4" of me, towering over Joey, who was almost a foot shorter. Rubino, about 5'9", quickly stood as well. "What can I do for you guys?" the comedian asked warily as he approached. "We're celebrating St. Patrick's Day and want to wish you a happy one," I said, like a moron. Bishop smiled. "How are you celebrating?" Thinking very slowly, I said, "We're going to get ripped." Joey looked bemused and said to Rubino, "How about you?" Whereupon Rubino put forth the immortal line, "I'm Italian." The conversation went downhill from there and ended seconds later. On page 176 of my first book, The O'Reilly Factor, I briefly mentioned that we attempted to extort a dinner from Joey before sitting down. Grim, but true. Dazed by the experience, I then sat through the show. I swear I can't remember another thing about it. After leaving the studio, a jazz Rubino immediately called Marist and spoke with his co-editor at The Circle. After listening to the story, the guy didn't believe that Rubino and I would be on The Tonight Show later that evening. Let me repeat that. He did not believe. Instantly, I knew this was a big break. So we leaped into the Duster and drove quickly back to Poughkeepsie. Along the way, we hatched the plot. The Tonight Show is taped at 5 in the afternoon, so driving fast, we got back to Marist College around 8:45 p.m. Our plan was to make as many cash bets as possible, asserting that we would be seen and heard on NBC that very evening. Racing through the dorms, we covered about $200 in wagers from fellow students, some in various stages of intoxication. Ignoring derisive chants from foolish skeptics, Rubino and I finished recording the bets and then forced some freshman tech expert to move a TV onto the college theater stage. No personal TVs were allowed in the rooms back then. By 11:30, the place was filled to capacity. At exactly 11:35, a giant roar went up from the crowd. The next day, the campus was on fire. Some of the professors were appalled, truculently accusing Rubino and me of giving the college a bad name. We had mentioned to Joey that we were attending Marist. I replied in the circle that if Professor Zuccarello thought the college's name could get any worse, he was nuts. And so it went. Good story, right? Besides entertainment, my point for even bringing it up is to demonstrate that before I got into the TV news business, I had zero experience with power brokers and only two rather pathetic brushes with the fame game. It was only after I got into the news business that I began to understand how the American system really works. Power drives this country, and there are both good and bad people behind the wheel. To me, it is simply amazing that I have traveled from Ben Casey and Joey Bishop to personally knowing many of the most powerful people in the world. Not bragging, just reporting. So let's take a look at how things really work. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. Even though I firmly believe the USA is a noble nation, I also understand full well that some powerful Americans are not noble. See Jeffrey Immelt. Currently, it's my job to deal with these people and, if need be, persuade them to do the right thing. Sometimes I'm successful in that quest, sometimes I'm not. When I can't reason with powerful people who, in my view, are hurting the folks, I expose them on national TV and radio. This, of course, does not make some power brokers big fans of mine. Who is this punk O'Reilly spouting off on cable, they must be thinking? How can this be happening? I must confess that annoying powerful bad guys is a great part of my job. In assessing the powerful, there are many avenues to explore. The grandest boulevard, of course, is the domain of the most powerful person in the world, the President of the United States. Your humble correspondent, the bold, fresh guy, has interacted with four presidents, and again, I always wonder what my late father would have thought about that. Remember, he had a cynicism about the powerful, and while he loved his country, he was never in awe of presidents or anyone else. So I am left wondering just how my father would have processed my access to these people. Anyway, let's begin the power presentation with the president I know best. Three times I have interviewed George W. Bush, and here is my assessment. I believe he is an honest man. I believe his presidency was challenged by extraordinarily difficult circumstances that only a few other chief executives have ever faced. The terror attack on September 11th instantly changed the world, introducing a complex set of unique circumstances to Americans. Understanding that, I do cut President Bush some slack, unlike many in the media. That being said, President Bush has made some major mistakes, most of which were exacerbated by what I call the rich guy syndrome. Let me explain. For people like me, raised in working-class homes, disaster is always in play, constantly present on the horizon. As I mentioned, both my mother and father were possessed by a nagging fear that stuff would inevitably go wrong. This is common among everyday folks who have to work hard to get by. But Americans born into wealth and power usually do not have that fear. That's because things always seem to work out for them. Money buys security from harm and often can mitigate difficult situations. Power, as we've discussed, leads to opportunities. You must accept that truism in order to understand President Bush and his approach to vexing problems. The crowning achievement of the Bush administration, usually ignored by the bitter left-wing media, is the hurt it put on al-Qaeda. Within a year after 9/11, President Bush and his allies had delivered a series of devastating blows to the Islamic extremist community. The Taliban were routed in Afghanistan, dozens of al-Qaeda leaders and operatives around the world were captured or killed, and scores of countries cooperated with America in freezing suspected terrorist bank accounts. President Bush was flush with success. In most polls, his approval ratings were above 80%. Then came the invasion of Iraq and the unraveling of the president's initial terror war success. As you know, the Bush lied crowd cannot stop screaming that the president fabricated the reasons for removing the tyrant Saddam Hussein. The prevailing wisdom on the far left is that Bush is a savage warmonger intent for venal reasons on imposing American dominance on the world. The anti-Bush partisans paint a harsh picture, and unfortunately, many people believe it. But that analysis is largely bull. In fact, when I interviewed former White House spokesperson Scott McClellan on The Factor, he couldn't back up his well-publicized book assertion that the Bush administration used propaganda to take the nation to war. I crushed McClellan by saying President Clinton and British Prime Minister Tony Blair had backed up Mr. Bush. They saw the same intel on Iraq that he did. Were they pushing propaganda as well? McClellan looked confused. In fact, the mantra that Bush lied about Iraq is itself a lie, and completely absurd on its face. No, there was compelling evidence that Saddam had been hoarding deadly weapons of mass destruction and could well hand them off to a variety of terrorists, Hamas, Muslim Brotherhood, etc., whenever he chose to do that. Captured documents after Saddam's fall proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the dictator told his own generals he had secret caches of WMDs and was ready to use them. Many of Saddam's generals now confirm this. On worldwide television, former CIA Director George Tenet looked me in the eye and said he presented President Bush with intel that also confirmed the existence of Iraqi WMDs and other dangerous plots. Of course, the WMD intelligence turned out to be wrong, but there's a big difference between a mistake and a lie. Nonetheless, I have to agree with critics that the post-Saddam planning by the Bush administration was abysmal. Soon after Saddam was pushed from power, I told my audience that American forces were not nearly aggressive enough in controlling the looting that was taking place in Iraq. I was amazed and depressed by the chaos. Why wasn't this kind of lawlessness anticipated? But apparently President Bush was not equally appalled. Furthermore, as subsequent events spiraled downward in Iraq, the president was very slow to react. Why? Well, my view is that he believed it would all work out. Again, that's the mindset of rich guys. Everything will turn out okay because it always has turned out okay. And the president was not alone in his lack of urgency. On a daily basis, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and others were telling Bush that the problems in Iraq were under control. Why did he believe them? Well, because those men had been correct about the outcome of the Afghan campaign, while some other presidential advisors had counseled against a quick anti-Taliban action. In Iraq, of course, Cheney and Rumsfeld turned out to be wrong. But beyond policy mistakes, the president did not seem to feel the urgency of the situation, and thus Iraq could very well wind up destroying his legacy. You can also make a case that the same Bush mindset worsened the Hurricane Katrina situation. This is cold, not partisan analysis. Americans are rightly confused and saddened by the Iraq situation. It has cost this country enormous blood and treasure. However, it's important to understand what really happened there. America did nothing immoral by removing a murderous dictator who had violated the first Gulf War ceasefire 17 times and who was hell-bent on causing trouble for America. No, the USA did not fail morally. We just weren't very smart in anticipating the complexity of the Iraqi battlefield. A more apprehensive president, say Abraham Lincoln, might have sensed the extent of the debacle sooner than President Bush did, and acted more swiftly to correct the situation. This is, of course, Monday morning quarterbacking, but if you study Lincoln, you'll see a man who reacted to bad news quickly. I mention President Lincoln because in an extensive private conversation I had with President Bush about Iraq and other matters, Lincoln was on his mind. After I interviewed the former president in October 2006, he invited me to have lunch. I was stunned. Very few people have ever treated me to lunch. It takes great courage. In the dining room adjacent to the Oval Office, we talked off the record for about 30 minutes. I was impressed by the president's knowledge and analysis of history. He clearly believed that his tough strategy against Islamic extremism had prevented further attacks on U.S. soil and that history would vindicate the Iraq campaign. You can decide about the president's belief, but I can tell you that personally, he seems to be a good guy. People I trust have told me that he's kind to his staff, generally respectful of the immediate needs of others around him, and much more forgiving of insults than I am. In fact, I asked the president on camera if he harbored any resentment toward those who hate and spread lies about him. He said no. Then after the cameras were off, I said something like, "Come on, Mr. President, these people must make you angry." He just smiled and said, "They really don't." Interviewing a president, as I've said before, is the toughest thing in journalism. There's a line you simply cannot cross because you must respect the office. With everybody else, I can aggressively challenge dubious answers and, within boundaries, even mock them. You may have seen a bit of that in my famous interview with Senator Hillary Clinton. I gave her some jazz that I could never have thrown at the commander-in-chief. I was respectful but forceful while speaking to Mrs. Clinton. Talking with the president is obviously a different deal. Certainly I can challenge, but I can't denigrate the man or woman in any way. If you deviate from being respectful, most of the folks watching will hold it against you, no matter what their political bent. That's just the way it is with the commander-in-chief. Having a president show you around the White House is somewhat intoxicating, and of course, the president realizes this. Each room is meticulously cared for, and stories about past presidents abound. If you're like me and study history, there's no more interesting place in the world with the possible exception of Vatican City. I visited the White House a number of times, and it is always thrilling. My presidential interviews with Mr. Bush have been major highlights in my long career. In each case, I felt I was fair but tough. In fact, President Bush the Elder told me he enjoyed watching the joust with his son on TV. Even though I pushed the president hard to define coerced interrogation methods and openly doubted his immigration policy, when Mr. Bush failed to explain exactly how he would secure the southern border, I said directly, "You know, Mr. President, many Americans will not like your answer." To which he responded, "Well, that's my answer." Okay. As for President George Herbert Walker Bush, I have corresponded with him over the years and can tell you the man understands more about how this world works than anyone else I know. Some left-wing writers have speculated there's a tension between the Bushes, that the father and son disagree on some important issues. I have not seen that. I promise to keep President Bush the Elder's comments to me private until he dies, and I will keep that promise. He has always been kind enough to brief me when I need to know something important about policy, and I greatly appreciate that. As you probably understand, in a world full of deceit and spin, it's very tough to get the truth of some matters. Having access to a patriot like President George H.W. Bush has, for me, made forming opinions on some vital issues much easier. By the way, in the lunch I had with the younger President Bush, I have absolutely no idea what I ate. I simply can't remember. I was so engrossed in the conversation, I could have eaten a caterpillar, for all I know. President Bill Clinton. Unfortunately, President Clinton has not deemed it necessary to enter the no-spin zone, although I've tried hard to convince him to do so. I've met him and we chatted briefly, but our contact has been mainly between surrogates, and I've never formally interviewed him. That's a shame because the conversation would be interesting and I would value his opinion on a number of issues. In my view, Mr. Clinton sees the world in a unique way, but has rarely been challenged in the media, so we don't really know why he thinks what he thinks. He's good at making statements, but how he's arrived at his belief system remains a mystery, at least to me. Maybe after he reads this book, he'll see the wisdom of speaking to me just as his wife finally did. Somehow, I don't think Mr. Clinton was ever a bold, fresh guy and may not be fond of my approach. His best-selling autobiography is interesting, but doesn't really get to the heart of the matter. I'd like to know what's behind the curtain. President Clinton, of course, is the polar opposite of President Bush. Raised in a working-class broken home, Clinton is as far away from the rich guy syndrome as you could possibly get. The fact that he rose up from the tiny town of Hope, Arkansas to become president is astounding. Even those who don't like him have to admit that. It would be unfair to me to attempt to define how President Clinton wields his power because I simply don't know. Stories about his temper and sense of entitlement are legion. Stories about my temper are legion. Who the hell knows what's true in his case? So I'm not going to waste your time speculating. I will say that from my vantage point, Bill and Hillary Clinton greatly enjoy power. While I never got the feeling that George and Laura Bush woke up every day relishing the perks of their position, I believe the Clintons eat that relish up. I could be wrong. Covering Bill Clinton's presidency on The Factor was a nightmare. After the Lewinsky episode, there was no reasoning with anyone on either side. Partisans ran wild, accusations flew like migrating bats. But after a while, all the stupid jokes and rank hatred got tedious. Ken Starr was boring. It's Just About Sex was incredibly boring. The whole sordid mess seriously damaged the country, but few actually realized what was going on. While we Americans were wallowing in voyeurism, Al-Qaeda was killing people overseas and planning even greater massacres. Most of us, even in the corridors of power, barely noticed. Clinton associates have told me that the president often watches The Factor. If it's true, I'm glad. And I tell those people to inform the president that he is far more powerful and knowledgeable than I am. Therefore, he should demonstrate that by coming on my program and setting me straight on a number of important issues. If his wife can do it, he can. President Gerald Ford. Believe me, I tried hard to get President Ford to talk about the impeachment of President Clinton. In phone calls and letters, I tried in every way to get the man on the record about the action. He simply would not offer an opinion. In a series of interviews conducted for Parade magazine, the most widely read weekly publication in the world, by the way, I asked President Ford scores of questions about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At that time, in the fall of 1997, the Clinton scandal was red hot. Ford was candid on everything but Clinton, telling me that the rules of the fraternity of former presidents forbade him to criticize the current chief executive. Since then, both Bill Clinton and especially Jimmy Carter have hammered President Bush hard, so I guess the frat rules have changed for some people. Anyway, in our chats, I found President Ford to be a nice guy. He did, however, get a bit angry over the fact that his administration had not been praised more. He pointed to the 1975 Helsinki Accords, which stopped Soviet military intrusions in Eastern Europe. Also, he was proud of his work in undermining the South African apartheid system. The only time President Ford actually got huffy was when I asked about the Richard Nixon pardon. Clearly, he felt he lost in 1976 to Jimmy Carter because he let Nixon skate on the Watergate mess. But Ford was adamant that he had made the correct decision, saying he had to stop the hatred because it was damaging America. I believe he was right. I enjoyed talking with President Ford, who I think was stimulated by the conversations as well. No question in my mind that he enjoyed his power and status, first as House Speaker, then as President, finally as an elder statesman. If we look back on his career, the man tried to do the right thing by his country. He was no visionary or crusader, but he was a patriot. Gerald Ford, like many presidents, came from a modest background. But once he left the Oval Office, he didn't hesitate to amass a fortune by serving on corporate boards and earning enormous speaking fees. As his 2007 tax returns prove, Bill Clinton has done exactly the same thing. Is there anything wrong with that? You make the call. President Jimmy Carter. It is safe to say that Jimmy Carter has used some of his power to avoid talking to me about anything. He'll talk with the Hamas killers, thereby legitimizing them in the eyes of some folks, but forget about conversing with the bold, fresh guy. I do take this personally. Over the years, we've invited Mr. Carter on the Factor dozens of times, but his people barely return our calls. When they did deign to, I believe there was some sneering going on. This despite the fact that President Carter seems to write a book every 3 weeks and will appear on cooking shows to promote his work. So there's no question in my mind that Carter does not get the bold, fresh guy, whose program sells tons of books for smart authors. Or maybe he does understand and simply despises me. That has been known to happen. To be fair, President Carter is smart to avoid me, because I think he was a disaster as president. I think he's an okay guy, building those homes for Habitat for Humanity and such. But as leader of America, the guy was scary. It all crystallized for me at the 2004 Democratic Convention in Boston. There were President Carter and his wife, Rosalynn, sitting next to Michael Moore, the notorious American basher. The Carters were beaming as TV cameras caught them yucking it up with the rotund provocateur. I mean, think about it. There sat the powerful Jimmy Carter giving his ex-presidential seal of approval to Moore, a man who thinks Fidel Castro is the greatest. Okay. There's little more for me to say about Carter. During the hostage crisis, Iran made him look like little Bo Peep. On his watch, Americans had to line up for hours to get gas for their cars. Richard Nixon might have been a liar and a crook, but at least he had a clue about the real world and how it works. Carter was given power by the American people and rewarded their judgment by finishing his term looking like Sweet Pea from the Popeye comics. Some guys just can't handle life in the power lane. That was Jimmy Carter. Oprah. Okay, it's not even close. Oprah Winfrey is the most powerful woman in the world. Sorry, Hillary. Born into deep poverty in 1954, this woman makes Bill Clinton look like Prince Charles in the humble beginnings department. Compared to her upbringing in Mississippi, I was raised in the Taj Mahal. And even worse, Miss Winfrey recalls being molested as a child by several male relatives and friends of her family. Add it all up and Oprah's climb to the top of the power mountain is simply stunning. No other word for it. So what does this say about America, Michael Moore? What kind of power does Oprah wield? Well, Parade Magazine reports she makes $260 million a year. That's about $1 million every day she actually works. Whoa. Basically, earning that kind of money means that Oprah Winfrey can do or buy anything she wants on this earth as long as it's legal and for sale. Like Lola in Damn Yankees, whatever Oprah wants, Oprah gets. Think about that. There are no material limits for Oprah. Nothing she cannot afford. Are you still thinking? Does Oprah's situation sound good? Okay, here's the downside. Having that kind of money can literally drive a person crazy. Here's why. Remember those glittering Christmas mornings when you were a kid? Mine were thrilling, the highlights of my childhood. The anticipation of getting fun stuff makes most kids happy for weeks. That's why Christmas is magic. Most children experience true joy during that season. But it was the anticipation, the rarity of the experience, that conjured up the magic. If, like Oprah, you can have Christmas every day of the year, there isn't much anticipation, is there? I mean, the thrill of obtaining something exceptional or unexpected or long-awaited just doesn't exist. With everything almost instantly available, everything becomes rather ordinary. For that reason, the ultra-wealthy, if they are not ultra-careful, can become bored, jaded, or even worse, sadistic or self-destructive. The awful behavior of some celebrities and power brokers illustrates that point beyond a reasonable doubt. Just ask Caligula. To me, the most interesting part of life is achieving goals and overcoming challenges. If all goals are met and there are no challenges, life can become tedious. That's what Alexander the Great, the bored, meant by whining in his early 30s that there were no more worlds to conquer. The opportunity to experience the most unexpected and best challenges is what gets most human beings up in the morning. Also, with most of the world struggling in some way, it is not unusual for the very rich to feel very guilty about their material prosperity. Why do I deserve all that comfort? Along with tedium, that kind of subliminal guilt can consume a person and cause great unhappiness, which is why we see so many self-inflicted wounds among rich folks. Elvis, Ernest Hemingway, Marilyn Monroe, Kurt Cobain, people like that had a lot going for them, yet somehow they chose to destroy themselves. All the fame and money weren't enough. But back to Oprah. We know each other slightly. For a while, we both worked for King World, a television syndication company, and our paths occasionally crossed. Years later, while promoting Culture Warrior, I did a town meeting on her Chicago-based talk show. I enjoyed it. Oprah challenged me, but also listened to what I had to say. Unlike most in show business, Oprah has been very fair to me. Because I know people who have worked with her, I have a pretty good idea how Oprah wields her enormous power. From the jump, she's been smart, anticipating that some people would try to extort money from her, a very common occurrence in the world of the wealthy. She requires employees to sign a non-disparagement and confidentiality agreement. Badmouth Oprah, you're in court. In addition, her lawyers are super aggressive in protecting her brand. Use clips of her show without permission, you're in court. I admire how Oprah has used her power to protect herself and her operations. She's shrewd and tough, and that's a compliment. But even Oprah can't derail the tabloid train, so she simply ignores it. Another smart move. Very rarely will you see Miss Winfrey comment on anything or even consent to be interviewed. Like most truly powerful people, she controls her environment. Good for her. Most important, she uses her power to help children. And this is where she sets herself apart from most other moguls. In addition to giving millions to help poor and abused kids, Oprah uses her program to encourage society to aggressively protect endangered children. Right now, it is reported that her angel network has raised more than $51 million for such causes as Hurricane Katrina relief and educating poor girls in South Africa. Obviously, this is how power should be used, to aid those who are most vulnerable to harm and least able to help themselves. Oprah's program is seen in more than 130 countries and continues to dominate American daytime TV. So if Oprah likes a book, it becomes a bestseller. If Oprah likes a recipe, that's what you might be having for dinner. It's a small world after all, and Oprah is calling some serious shots all around the globe. Yet in order to remain the most powerful woman in the world, Miss Winfrey has to be careful. Her endorsement of Senator Barack Obama greatly helped him, no question, but it may not have helped her. Millions of Hillary Clinton supporters, as well as many Republicans, were not real thrilled when Oprah decided to become a political force. After she rallied for Obama, some polls actually showed Ms. Winfrey losing popularity among the folks. Americans are funny like that. They often admire the successful, but they don't want anyone becoming too powerful. That might be the message for Oprah as far as the political arena is concerned. Nevertheless, I continue to admire what Oprah has chosen to do with her power. When in 2007 a scandal broke out about alleged sexual abuse at the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls, the $40 million school she built near Johannesburg in South Africa, I defended her. While some in the press used the opportunity to cheap shot Ms. Winfrey, my analysis simply stated that the woman couldn't possibly control the actions of every employee she hires. Those of us who do have power well understand the old adage, no good deed goes unpunished. In South Africa, Oprah tried to do a good thing. Give her a break. Finally, there is a larger point at play with Oprah. The fact that a black woman from a poor background can command so much power once again illustrates the greatness of America. This could not happen in most other countries. I'm not sure that is widely understood. Regular Americans bestow awesome power on Oprah by watching her TV program and respecting her opinions on a variety of subjects. The folks do this, not the government or some pinhead media executive. And when the people deem you worthy of power, you have been granted both a supreme compliment and a huge responsibility. So far, Oprah has risen to her incredible occasion. She can move the dial on many issues and has often made lives better. Donald Trump. As far as wielding power goes, the polar opposite of Oprah is Donald Trump, the brash real estate mogul who dabbles in television for his own amusement. But don't underestimate this guy. Trump has the ability to revitalize entire urban neighborhoods, and his operations provide work for hundreds of thousands of Americans. The ability to employ people on a mass scale is a definite power indicator. Simply put, there is little nuance in Trump's power base. It is derived from cold, hard cash. If money talks, Mr. Trump's lips are exhausted. He controls a huge real estate empire by using a combination of savvy business connections and sheer intimidation. I've known Trump for years, and he's a true force of nature. Unlike presidents or even Oprah Winfrey, Donald doesn't depend on masses of people for his success or power. No, his enormous clout comes from partnering up with a few high rollers who like his maverick style. They want to invest or live in his buildings, gamble in his casinos, and present a powerful image like Trump does. Truthfully, I know nothing of Trump's business dealings. That's not my area. Unless he breaks the law, his private dealings are his own business. I've heard he's a ruthless guy. I've heard I'm a ruthless guy. The truth is elusive in these matters, except for me. I can assure you the bold, fresh guy is a picture of benevolence. However, I may not be objective in that analysis. Also, I have no idea how Trump wields his power day to day. He looks like a tough guy to me. I mean, it's hard to imagine a guy like Trump taking much jazz from anyone. Clearly, he goes out of his way to project an aura of success and confidence, and what you see on TV is what you get in person. I know this because I've spent some time with Trump. We are both baseball fans, so a couple times a year, we'll go out to Yankee Stadium and, while watching the game, kick world events around. Trump is well-informed and insightful. For example, he understands exactly what I've done with the Factor brand because it is similar to what he's done with the Trump brand. In addition to having an acute interest in the world, both Trump and I are well known and exceedingly controversial. So we have some common ground. By the way, I generally keep my social conversations private. If somebody says something to me at a ball game or a dinner, I don't spread it around. Why would I? Gossip is stupid and counterproductive. What my friends tell me stays in Vegas, or in Levittown, or wherever. But I don't think Donald Trump will mind my analyzing his power because he himself has done it a number of times in his books. The big thing about Trump is that he gets things done. This is the hallmark of the powerful. When the city of New York dithered around for 5 years, unable to reconstruct an ice skating rink in Central Park, Trump stepped in and rehabilitated the Wallman facility in 6 months. Somehow he convinced the tough city unions to cooperate and work fast. Very few politicians have ever done that. Check out Boston's Big Dig if you don't believe me. It's the same all over the country. Trump's buildings go up quickly and efficiently, while many public works projects seem to take forever. Why is Trump so much more effective? That's easy. He demands results, and people fear not delivering for him. So on the surface, at least, you can compare Trump's power to Oprah's in this way. His is driven by trepidation, while her clout is derived from love. But look a bit deeper, and you'll see that Oprah is also feared, even though she does not openly work that angle. Nonetheless, it would not be wise for someone in politics or show business to alienate Miss Winfrey. Of course, alienating Donald Trump is foolish as well and would very likely lead to a public bloodletting. And it is on this point that I chide him. Remember that dopey public brawl between Trump and Rosie O'Donnell? It all began in December 2006 after Trump publicly scolded one of his beauty contestants, Miss USA Tara Conner, for misbehaving. You may have seen the sensational photos that featured Miss Conner in a variety of salacious poses. There were also allegations of substance abuse. After the woman agreed to counseling, Trump allowed her to stay in the pageant. However, the situation angered Rosie O'Donnell, who was then co-hosting the daytime Yak Fest, The View, on ABC. Ms. O'Donnell quickly got up close and personal, citing Trump's past tabloid exploits and accusing him of hypocrisy and extreme hubris, which are never good. Trump immediately fired back, calling Ms. O'Donnell an astonishing variety of names, including a big fat pig and a mental midget. Rosie, rising to the challenge as only she can, rejoined that Trump was a pimp and a degenerate. While even the little rascals would have been embarrassed, the jaded media swooned with joy. Then Mr. Trump announced he was going to sue Miss O'Donnell. That's when I booked him on the factor. The following is a partial transcript of the conversation where I try to convince Trump that getting down in the mud with O'Donnell is not helping him. O'Reilly, don't you understand that Rosie is making herself look bad? Trump, hey, Bill, there are two types of people in this world. People that take it and people that don't take it. Rosie is a bully. O'Reilly, all right, so I'm not going to be able to convince you to beat her intellectually and stay out of the personal. Trump, this is ultimately intellectual. You know, I went to the best school. I went to the Wharton School of Finance. O'Reilly, that's what I'm telling you. Why do you have to talk about her girlfriend then? Just talk about the erroneous thing she says. Trump, I feel sorry for her. I'm not talking about her girlfriend. I feel sorry for her girlfriend. How would you like to have to kiss Rosie? O'Reilly, that's what I'm talking about. You don't need to do that. Trump, I feel sorry for this girl. I just found out her name is Kelly. She looks like a lovely young woman. Too bad she got stuck with Rosie. O'Reilly, okay, now the lawsuit. You can't win, and I'll tell you why. You have to prove damages, and you're not going to be able to prove damages. Trump, you know, Bill, do me a favor. Don't be my lawyer. O'Reilly, have you thought about that? Trump, I think about everything. O'Reilly, you can show malice, but not prove damages. Trump, Bill, don't be my lawyer. I like you. You're my friend. Don't be my lawyer. O'Reilly, can I be your advisor? Trump, yes. O'Reilly, don't use any more personal attacks. Trump, I will take that very seriously. Okay. A few days after that interview, the spat died, and ultimately Trump did not sue. However, I think it's safe to say that the entire sordid joust energized and satisfied him. You see, Donald Trump believes that even cheap publicity enhances his power and brand because it gets his name out there. But he's wrong. Rosie O'Donnell has no power whatsoever. She can huff and puff all day long, but nothing much will change. As with most entertainers, Rosie works because others more powerful than she is allow her to work. She and 99% of other show business people are hired mercenaries whose plug can be pulled at any time. So by publicly slugging it out with Rosie, Trump elevated her to his power level, while at the same time sinking into the no-class zone. Does that sound smart to you? Remember, Trump controls his operations. He doesn't need the approval of some TV mogul to get paid. He is 1,000 times more powerful than Rosie O'Donnell will ever be. Very simply, he should have issued a statement that Miss O'Donnell was misguided and misinformed about the pageant controversy and said nothing else. In fact, you have to think long and hard to find any entertainer with real power. The lead singer of U2, Bono, does have the ability to raise big money for charity and right some societal wrongs, but he is a rarity. Most celebrities are basically just temporary diversions for the folks. Usually the famous don't understand that, but truly powerful people should. For some reason, Donald Trump engages in feuds with folks far below him on the power scale. He should rethink that. As we all know, fame is fleeting and so is power. When you have it, you should use it to do some good. Call me crazy, but I don't think trading insults with Rosie O'Donnell falls into that category. Also, there are some people who might do business with Donald Trump but are afraid to do so because if anything goes south, they might be on the receiving end of some Rosie-type treatment. Trump should consider that. I do agree with Trump that there are two kinds of people in the world, and if you are being mistreated, you should fight back. But there are a variety of ways in which to wage combat. As I've stated, before the factor publicly goes after somebody, we try to reason with them behind the scenes. It is only when they reject the soft approach that we go in hard. In the O'Donnell case, I did have to take the woman on a few times myself, because she is basically out of control. But we did it strictly on issues. As mentioned, when she implied that the 9/11 attack was an inside job, we used a study by Purdue University that analyzed the World Trade Center damage to illustrate just how crazy Rosie's words really were. We did not call her fat. Finally, there is nothing wrong with Trump or any powerful person calling attention to unfairness or just plain nonsense. I do it all the time and wish more powerful people would step up. When a powerful person publicly points to wrongdoing, that wrongdoing gets some exposure in the media. Obviously, that is a good thing. Too many powerful Americans use their status simply to help themselves. That is a bad thing. Bill O'Reilly. Once in a while, a friend will ask me something like, "O'Reilly, do you really know how powerful you are?" That kind of question brushes me back. I just never think about my job in that way. Of course, I can affect some lives, and as I've mentioned, I'm always careful about my actions in that regard. But the fact that I hold some power does not really mean much to me. Besides, when it comes to what other people are doing with their lives, I've always been a libertarian kind of guy. As long as you're not hurting anyone, have a good time. Sure, I have my philosophy and gravitate toward people who see life the way I do, but I'm not a missionary. I'll put forth my case on a belief or issue, stand back, and let you decide its merits. Even though I'd like you to see it my way, I am not in the persuasion business, and I don't dislike people who see life differently than I do, as long as they are sincere. The power deal, however, does have its moments. Because I'm seen and heard by millions every day, opportunities to do some good come along quite often. Here's just one small example. In March 2007, the factor learned that a 10-year-old Iowa girl was dying of a brain tumor. Her only wish was to see her incarcerated father one last time. Unfortunately, the man was serving federal time in North Dakota, about 500 miles from his daughter. A convicted drug dealer, he had asked for a special furlough, but the warden had turned him down. My investigators looked at the situation, and it quickly crystallized. The father had just about completed his sentence, and freedom was just a few months away. Also, a federal judge had no problem with the supervised visit, and furloughs of this kind have been granted in the past. So, I went on the air and politely but firmly asked the warden to reconsider. He did. The girl and the father had their last visit. She died a few days later. Shortly after that, an old friend of mine called to say that the story had made her cry. She thanked me for doing it and said she believes this is why I have been granted the good fortune of national success. I agree. That's why I try to use my power in this direction as much as I can. We're tough on the factor, but we're also compassionate and believe in redemption. Our record over the years proves it. As for the perks of power, they're fine, I guess. I don't really care much about them. Even though it's nice to get good seats at events and be able to travel quickly without hassle. But basically, it's the work that I enjoy, not the benefits that come from the work. Whenever I see a famous person acting like a jerk, I cringe. I hope I never insult the folks by acting like I'm above them in some way. If I do, let me know immediately. Summing up this chapter, it's clear to me that many people crave power and influence, but few really have it. Those who do acquire power either derive it from the folks or grab it by getting their hands on big money. Either way, all of the really powerful people have an obligation to make the world a better place, and those who don't are subject to scrutiny from the factor. That's how I use my power. By the way, my seventh grade teacher, Sister Thomas, did go out of her way to emphasize that it is harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, possibly a reference to a small needle's-eyed door in the Jaffa gate at the Jerusalem wall, although some Christians take the Bible passage literally. I recall Clement's reaction to that lesson was to say that he was glad you could get cigarettes, Camel brand, in heaven or some stupid thing. But you get the idea. Wealth and fame and clout look great from a distance. But again, be careful what you wish for. Power to the people indeed. But understand, it's a very hot plate. Chapter 14, Mysteries of the Universe. Don't try to plan me or understand me. I can't stand to be understood. The turtles, let me be. Now, you might want to skip this chapter. No question, it is going to be the most ridiculous part of the entire audiobook. No spin. You see, I am a popular culture vulture, and have been ever since Davy Crockett and Georgie Russell were roaming around on the Disney show back in the 1950s. And over the years, there have been a number of pop culture things that, for a variety of reasons, I simply do not understand. With some remorse, I have chosen to drop some of these mysteries on you. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be doing this. But I can't help it. It's just who the bold, fresh guy is. The singer Paul Simon, who's a few years older than your humble correspondent, has stated that he believes he was born at exactly the right time, that over the years he has experienced great change in nearly every decade of his life. Simon, in my estimation, is right on. From the advent of rock and roll, to the turbulent anti-war 60s, including the sexual revolution, to the disco 70s, to the high-tech world we have right now, it seems like the baby boomers have surfed the crest of every wave that washed in dramatic change. That's why I'm glad I'm a boomer, grateful to have experienced so much. But along the way, certain things have struck me as inexplicable. These events, people, and beliefs have stayed with me because they are totally beyond my comprehension. As you are about to find out, most of them are trivial and demonstrate the level of immaturity that I must live with every day. Pray for me. The following ramblings are not in any particular order. I'm just going along with my personal stream of consciousness. Again, I apologize. Let's begin with Brad Pitt, a complete mystery of the universe to me. I am definitely not understanding Pitt mania and the attention this man gets. Good-looking guy, sure, and he's a pretty good actor. But if you can miss the movie Troy, by all means do so. However, Brad Pitt commands millions in salary and is in the entertainment press almost daily. Why? Well, he's involved with Angelina Jolie, and that union became notorious because Pitt divorced actress Jennifer Aniston, who seems like a nice woman, to make it all happen. But so what? All of that occurred years ago, and despite a mediocre movie resume, Mr. Pitt is still a huge star. Again, not getting this at all. On the music front, Madonna bugs me. Her early songs are catchy, and I like the fact that she came from humble Michigan roots before rising to the top of the charts. According to Forbes magazine, she's now worth about $350 million. Quite an achievement for a working-class girl. But somehow, along the way, Madonna has succumbed to the awful disease of pretension. The latest symptom is her phony English accent. What is that all about? Is there no one alive who can tell Madonna that when she talks these days, she sounds like a transsexual version of Peter Sellers? Annoying? Off the chart. Next up is television. As a kid, I did not get Captain Kangaroo. When this guy came on, I left the room. I understand the actor who played him, Bob Keeshan, was a good guy in real life and that millions of kids loved the captain. But all I saw was a boring old guy who roamed around doing little of consequence. The bad haircut and cheap sweater didn't help either. I much preferred the double entendre king Soupy Sal's, which should tell you a lot about the bold, fresh guy. Still with me? There's plenty more. In the late summer of 1965, everybody was singing the number one hit song Hang On Sloopy by the McCoys. Everybody, that is, except me. I simply could not get past the incredibly dumb central theme. Sloopy sounded like a dog's name. To this day, I have never heard of a human being named Sloopy. Truly, the words of this song drove me nuts. Sloopy, I don't care what your daddy do, 'cause you know, Sloopy girl, I'm in love with you. I don't care what your daddy do? Are you kidding me? Good grief. The song stayed in the top 40 for 11 weeks, and during that time, I broached with my parents the subject of possibly moving to Argentina. Almost as bad was my guy Elvis singing a song called Do the Clam. That incredible travesty also happened in 1965, and it hurt me deeply. By that time, I had accepted the fact that the Big E was living in a daze, starring in films like Harem Scarum and Kissin' Cousins. But Girl Happy was the absolute worst. In that movie, Elvis sang the following lyrics. They made my head hurt. Do the clam, grab your barefoot baby by the hand. And not only did Elvis warble those words, he did so while wearing a white suit and black shoes. My God. On the political scene, Vice President Spiro Agnew was a complete mystery of the universe. His friends called him Ted, and for some unknown reason, Richard Nixon selected Ted to be his running mate in 1968. And they actually won the White House twice. But again, be careful what you wish for. In 1973, Ted was indicted for federal income tax evasion and was forced to resign, barely slithering out of a prison sentence. It turned out that Ted had raked in a total of $268,000 in bribes from builders while he was governor of Maryland. Nice. And when he asked the bribe givers to keep paying him in the Veep's office, they got teed off and called the feds. Eventually, investigators proved Ted to be a hardcore crook, as was Nixon. But at least Nixon knew stuff. Ted just ran around calling the press